our time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is the first full week in May, and yes, I have dedicated a whole 6 days of this podcast to one very special cause. Because the first full week in May is not only Emmy awareness, but it is millions missing weeks as well. Myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly referred to as ME, or you may know it as chronic fatigue syndrome, that is CFS, is a chronic, systematic neuroimmune disease. It affects at least 17 million people worldwide, and around 250,000 people in the UK alone, and those figures are just estimates. Symptoms vary for every person, but people with it often experience post-exertional malaise, that is, an array of symptoms brought on by either physical or mental exertion, or both. It quite often feels like having the flu, you experience all-over pain, you have sleep disturbance, problems with your sleep, cognitive impairments. The autonomic systems in the body are often messed up, that includes your nervous system, digestive system, and endocrine, and you experience hypersensitivity. ME has been fraught with controversy. For decades, and let's be honest, often still to this day, the medical profession and systems of government have not properly recognised it. People living with ME have been disbelieved, stigmatised, given incorrect treatment, or, quite often told, it is all in their heads. However, both ME Awareness and Millions Missing Weeks aim to change all this. So, over the course of the next 6 days, I'm going to have some very special guests on my podcast, one a day, giving us some insights into areas of this debilitating disease, which, in my opinion, aren't often talked about enough. So, let's get cracking with today's guest. It is now Saturday the 11th of May, and I am on episode number 5 of my special series, specifically focusing around Millions Missing Week and ME Awareness Week. ME being, of course, myalgic encephalomyelitis, and what I'm trying to explore across the series of podcasts is some of the issues surrounding the disease that are, in my opinion, underreported, that do not get the attention within the narrative of ME that they deserve, and for me that are crucial to bringing the community closer together and moving the community forward with regards to finally getting some proper answers and proper treatment. And today's topic is absolutely no exception to that rule. My guest wrote an article for ME Action Network, and it just blew me away in so much that it was a brilliant and pertinent summing up of one particular aspect of ME, but it was also devastating in its just rawness and realness and and the reality of the situation for my guest and for goodness knows thousands, possibly millions of people in her position. So I'm very honoured and privileged to have this lady on, because she was at her demo in Georgia just a few days ago. So I know probably it's tough for her to come on and do this, but I'm really thankful for her coming on. I'm very pleased to introduce Wilhelmina Jenkins. Wilhelmina, thank you so much for doing this. I do really appreciate it, and it's lovely to be able to speak to you.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're devoting such a good amount of time to the issues this week during Awareness Week. This is wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Just trying my best, as I always do. So, no, it's lovely to have you on. I mean, I want to start, so listeners can have some background. I want to start with your own experience of living with ME, because when I read your article, my initial reaction was, how long? I was quite flabbergasted. So tell the listeners about your experience of ME when you're diagnosed and what the progression of this has been like for you.
Absolutely. I became ill in 1983. I was at the time in graduate school at Howard University. I know some of your British listeners may not be familiar with Howard, but it's very well known here as one of the historically black universities, one of the premier ones in the country. I was doing my doctorate in physics. I was teaching physics both at Howard and at the University of the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. I had a family. It was a wonderful year. I was having a good time. I was working on bringing the number of minorities entering physics up higher. It's a very low number, and that was something that I put a lot of energy into. I was having a great year until February of 1983, when suddenly something went just terribly wrong. I know that many people start off with a recognizable virus. I did not. I was just moving along like normally, and then abruptly, and I could have circled the day if I'd known I wasn't going to get well, but I had no clue. Just abruptly, everything went to pieces in my body. I was in horrible pain. My legs ached so much I cried all the time from just the pain. I was completely exhausted. I couldn't exercise. Up until that point, I had been going to a spa near where I worked and exercising, and I found myself just gasping for air and leaning against the wall. I couldn't sleep at night. I would get lost going to where I was working. I worked at that time, I left that one out. I did a number of things at once. I worked at the National Bureau of Standards, which is now the National Institute of Standards and Technology, outside of Washington, D.C. And it was someplace I could get to easily. It was a 40-minute drive. I could get there very easily all the time. All at once, I couldn't find my way there. I would get lost and wander around and end up sitting in a parking lot and just crying for hours because I had no idea where I was all at once. The worst thing to me was losing my ability to think. I have loved math and physics my entire life, and I had expected to spend my life teaching physics, bringing people into physics who might not ordinarily come into the field, doing research with my students. I couldn't have imagined doing anything else. I figured I would still be at the blackboard with the chalk in my hand when I keeled over at an old age. I couldn't imagine anything standing in the way of that. I'm from the generation of African Americans who are always taught by their grandparents and parents, get your education because nothing can take that away from you. Well, all at once, something took it away from me, and I had no idea what it was. I ended up sitting at my desk looking at the work that I had written only a few weeks earlier, and I would look at it and go, I have no idea what this means. It was all lost to me. I could not think, and nothing could have prepared me for that. I didn't understand that at all. I was completely lost. I went to doctors, of course, in a complete panic. I went to doctors because I had never heard of this happening to anyone else. And my doctors, unlike some people, were very kind. I had very kind doctors. They said, yep, you're really sick. We have no idea what's wrong with you. In England at this point, you all were getting diagnosed with ME. We had no diagnosis over here. We just had either unkind doctors or kind doctors who were completely baffled. That's all we had. I, like everybody else who can't get an answer, I tried to change everything about myself to see if I could get some kind of traction, that I could get back on what I thought was my normal path in life. I couldn't. I tried everything I could think of. I changed locations where I went and taught at a small school in Pennsylvania. I said, if I only have one thing to do, maybe I can manage. I just kept getting worse. I ended up getting a grant just to finish up my PhD because I thought, aha, even less to do. Certainly I can focus on that, and then I can move on. I could not do that. I would sit in the library, and when I would sit in the library and couldn't read physics, and it sounds a little ridiculous, but what I would do would be to try to trick my brain into working. I would say, maybe read a poem, read a short story, try to get your brain cranking, and then slide into physics. To say the least, this was totally hopeless. I kept just going down, 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 and by 1987, I was completely disabled, and I have not been able to work a day since. It was like falling into a pit. It was a nightmare, and no one could tell me what was going on. In 1987, my family and I moved to Atlanta, Georgia. I'm from D.C. I'd lived in D.C. all my life. My husband had a job here at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta. And we moved here. And fortunately, I found a doctor who was more knowledgeable. And I was just lucky. By this time, I was depressed. And I'm the kind of person who looks up whatever's going on as much as possible. I just immediately go and look it up. I said to myself, aha, depression. They know how to treat this. So I very cheerfully went to a psychiatrist that I had looked up who I knew dealt with physical rather than just psychological depression. And I said to him, hi, I'm depressed. Can you treat this? I was very lucky that he knew to separate out what I was feeling after having lost everything that I had lost, which was a terrible loss to me. He separated that out, looked at the physical part that was left, and asked me, have you ever heard of chronic fatigue syndrome? I had not. I had never heard of the illness before. I had no clue about it at all. This was shortly after, this was in early 1988. It's been so many years, I tend to mix up the years a little bit. But this was early in 1988, and this was shortly after the CDC had its meeting to define this illness after the Lake Tahoe outbreak and the Lindenville, New York outbreak. And they were pretty dismissive of the disease and gave it a terrible name. Of course, chronic fatigue syndrome is probably the worst name anyone can think of to give a disease like this. But at least he knew the name. The name was familiar with him, and he was familiar with it because he was friends with some other doctors who had worked with CDC. CDC's right here in Atlanta. So I was in the right place at the right time. He was able to send me to an infectious disease doctor who was knowledgeable about this disease. But, of course, it's yes, we're checking you out. You definitely have chronic fatigue syndrome, but there's nothing we can do about it. And that's where he stopped. That's all there was. He did do one very helpful thing, which was to give me the address and phone number for the support group here in Atlanta. At the time, there was a very large in-person support group here, and it was totally mind-blowing to me to be in a support group with other people who had the same experience. I had been trying to talk to people who were depressed before, and I would say things like, I try to exercise, and then I end up in bed for a week, and they'd say, no, no, no. You mean you want to exercise, and then when you exercise, you feel better, and I go, not even a little bit. That's not even remotely what was going on. And to go to a support group where the first thing people said was, I tried to exercise last week, but I ended up in bed and I'm just getting out today. Or I tried swimming last week and I was in bed for days afterwards. Or even I took a long walk and I've been in bed for a month. And I'm going, this is amazing. These are my people. And then the most mind-blowing thing to me was, I remember my group leader said she had sat in her kitchen the day before holding something in her hand saying, this is not a tomato. This is not a tomato. And when her child came in, he pointed out it was an apple. She could not find the word. And I'm going, this is exactly it. Because at this point, I had lost words for almost everything. I have two children. At the time, they were pretty young. But I would say to myself, well, I taught them what the words were. they can help me out too. So I would say, what is this pointy thing that I'm sticking in the food? And they'd say, fork. And we'd move on from there. But that's the level at which my brain was operating. But it was an incredible relief to find out that there were other people all over the country who were going through the same nightmare. It wasn't just me. So I became involved with the support group. We broke down into smaller groups, and I became very close with the people in my support group. But there were very few. I talked to people all over the country, and very few people were being diagnosed with this illness. I talked to a lot of African Americans in other places who were having the same experience, but they were having trouble getting a diagnosis. They were having horrible trouble getting any kind of treatment. I can remember one young lady I spoke with, who's I still remember to this day, who had tried every doctor she could think of without being able to get help. And she was down to her last little bit of money. And she said that she'd bought a juicer with her money. And she said now she was just going to have to rely on juice and Jesus because the medical community had let her down. It's a horrible thing.
That's quite a staggering thing, the realization to come to for someone, yeah.
Absolutely. As I said, CDC is here in Atlanta, and since my doctor was one of those connected to CDC, I was a part of a study that was going on at the time at CDC. They were sort of lackadaisically studying this disease and brought lots of us in, took our information, took our histories, took our blood. I had gone in for some testing, and the woman who was doing the testing stopped in the middle and said to me, "Why are you the only African American we could find for this study?" Now, please understand, your English listeners may not know, Atlanta is filled with black people. It's one of the cities in America that's known as a mecca for black people. And she was telling me she couldn't find any. Well, I told her why, and I've been saying the exact same thing ever since. They don't know how to look.
You've just summed it up brilliantly there, actually, by saying you've been telling them why ever since, because I did want to throw to you about the piece you wrote, which was absolutely fantastic. And as I said in the introduction, it's so pertinent and so, so eloquently and yet devastatingly put. If you need to take a break to grab yourself a tea, coffee, water, or you just need to relax your ears for a few minutes, then take some time now because we will be back in a few seconds. So what is the why behind this? Because we say BME over here, Black and Minority Ethnic Community, African American, more predominantly if you're in the US, especially in your situation. Why? Mm-hmm. Why is it so underdiagnosed, also so underrepresented in the narratives and the groups that campaign around ME? Why were black people effectively being ignored throughout this period of time?
It's not just at that period of time, but until this time. And the reason is because of systemic elements in the United States that you may not have in England. You probably have prejudice and the usual sorts of things towards minorities in England. But here we have systemic reasons that that's true. Here in the United States, we don't have universal health care. All the health care is privatized. So people usually choose doctors based on their insurance coverage, what doctors are willing to take them as patients, and where they're located. As a result, a large number of African Americans are treated by African American doctors for historical reasons, too. There's a trust element there, too. Usually African Americans are more likely to trust African American doctors. The trick here is that they are also the busiest doctors in the country. They always have long waiting lists, lots of people in their offices, because there are a number of health problems that are significant for African Americans in this country, and those doctors are carrying more than their weight in taking care of those. Therefore, if you go to an African American doctor, including my own, I have a wonderful African American woman doctor, but she's my primary care doctor. What she knows about ME/CFS she's learned through me, but she has her waiting room is always stuffed. If you go in and you don't have cancer or heart disease or high blood pressure or diabetes or AIDS, pretty much the doctor will say, congratulations, send you home. Say, if you need some more rest, take a little rest, and that's it. And they'll move to the next patient. There's not enough time to see patients. There needs to be an outreach because these doctors do not know how serious this illness is. They have not been told. Back in the early days of this illness, every picture that you would see, as soon as my doctor told me that I had chronic fatigue syndrome, I did what I usually do, which is rush to a bookstore and see if I could find any information. The first thing I saw was a magazine. I opened it up. The story I read sounded exactly like my life. I was stunned. But, of course, the usual picture was on the article, which is usually a white woman leaning over to the side or collapsed on her desk, looking like she had a hard weekend, and not like someone who was seriously ill. And they were always pictures of white women. I had men in my support groups who were equally angry that there were never pictures of men. I had a good friend who said he was waiting for them to put an article in the magazine Field and Stream just so it would reach some men sometime. But it was even worse for African Americans. We were just wiped out of the picture. And even articles were written that would say crazy things like, these are the reasons African Americans do not get this illness, and would say crazy things like overexposure to pathogens at an early age, as if we were all out being exposed to all kinds of diseases, and therefore, unlike protected white people, we had built up our immune systems and anything, we could handle anything. Bizarre things. And I'm going, here I am. I'm right here. I'm sitting here. I had friends who went to a meeting with one of the people at CDC who was considered to be on our side at the time. And I was unable to go. I was too sick. I was bedridden at that point. I've been bedridden off and on, although I'm not at the moment. I was bedridden, and they all called me immediately after the meeting and said, there was an African-American woman in the audience, and the CDC person pointed at her and said, clone that woman. We cannot find any African-Americans with this disease. And, of course, my friends had talked to me for years, and they knew better. So they were falling out laughing. They thought it was unbelievable.
I'm not sure whether to laugh or just go, oh, my goodness.
Me too. But I was trying to break through. I had not worked on advocacy as hard as I did after my daughter became sick. My daughter became ill with this disease in 1991 as a teenager.
I didn't realize that. Oh, my goodness.
That was, everything that happened to me was not half as bad as when the day that she came home, collapsed on the couch, and was sick. I was in denial about it. I couldn't believe it. But within weeks, it was obvious that she had the same thing that I had. So here we were, two African Americans in one family, and they were still claiming that we did not get this illness. At that point, I became very angry, and my support group friends urged me to speak out at an upcoming CDC meeting about the fact that they were not finding African Americans because they had no idea where to look. I did not mention before, their entire groups, their medical associations, historically based in the African-American community. And for nursing, for physicians, for family care, even for dentistry, for all kinds of medical professionals, they had never thought to reach out to any of these groups, and they still have not done so. The CDC at this point was still saying, African-Americans just don't seem to get it, strangely enough. So I spoke up at that meeting. It was one of those meetings that sometimes happened with the CDC where the people who were supposed to be listening to us were not listening. In fact, there are pictures running around that show them fast asleep when the patients are trying to talk to them and get through. CDC was like a brick wall for a very long time. We were fortunate that Dr. Leonard Jason, who has done so much of the community-based work on this illness in the United States, did a wonderful study, a community-based study, in which he pointed out his results were that African Americans, as well as other minorities, get this disease at least the same rate as the majority population, possibly more. And at that point, CDC begrudgingly said, okay, we'll acknowledge that African Americans get this disease. But by that time, they had put out all the information indicating that that was not the case. And they never did anything to correct it. I got involved in advocacy just for that reason. By the time my daughter was sick, I was furious. She was terribly ill, and nobody was doing anything about this disease. So that was the point at which I began to speak out at different places, wherever I could. I spoke out at CDC, at NIH, small places, big places, tiny little radio stations, Oprah's TV show, wherever I could go. Any place I could go, I would try to speak out about this illness, even though I'm at heart a very shy person and a very private person. But I had to become something altogether different if I was going to make any kind of difference with this disease. And that became very urgently important to me.
No, I can imagine. I want to go off and off a bit of a tangent slightly in a minute and just throw my script away, because it's enthralling listening to you. I'm fascinated and appalled as well by some of the things you're telling me. There was this brilliant line. You sort of half described it, but there's this brilliant line in the article where you said that ME/CFS has been linked in the minds of the medical community as well as the general population with the image of a weary, middle-aged white woman. I mean, and that just sums it up to perfection to me. I mean, you've given a brilliant sort of potted history of why African-American community has been so marginalised from the acknowledgement of ME. Why do you think it's still the case? Because it's still... I have to say it, and I can't say it in any more sort of layman's, more explicit terms than I can. You do not see black people on any campaigns, on any narrative surrounding this still in 2019. They are few and far between. Is that down to the fact that they are still not getting the diagnoses? Is that what it is? Is that where we're at still?
To a large extent, yes. And we are not getting diagnosed because the people who helped create the problem, the CDC particularly, have not done anything to remedy it. There has to be some kind of a government outreach to these doctors. As I say, they're extremely busy doctors. Unless somebody makes it extremely clear to them that this is a doctor, that this is a disease that they can diagnose in their population and that is really crushing the lives of people in their own practices that they may not even recognize, they aren't going to be able to do anything about it. Someone has to reach out. We have all kinds of organizations and even historically black medical schools here. We have a number of them. CDC and the Health and Human Services of the government need to be able to reach out to these people and tell them how serious it is. They have not had that kind of outreach. All the outreach that has been done has been general. This needs to be specific to correct an erroneous image that was placed out there in the first place. It never should have happened, and since it did happen, they have the responsibility to fix it. I have great faith in what the government can do what it wants to. Both of my parents were scientists who worked for the United States government. I worked for the United States government as a physicist. My husband has worked in various labs at various times. We know what the government can do when it wants to do it. It has never put the effort behind expanding the image of this disease to include African Americans, and it's going to take a deliberate effort. Organizations have tried to do it. Several of the organizations here in the United States, including ME Action, who posted my piece that you were reading from, have tried, but it's very difficult if people are not being diagnosed. If you're not, it's the medical community that has to get the message. And until the medical community gets the message that African Americans must be included when you're thinking about people who have this disease, that when somebody comes into your office and is a college student and is suddenly ill, cannot think, cannot get out of bed, is in pain, you don't just tell them to go home and take a little rest. Perhaps they were under too much stress. you stop and ask them specific questions about this disease. Almost everyone with this disease knows the questions to ask. First question is, suppose you exert yourself today. What happens 48 hours later? That delayed post-exertional malaise is so key to this illness. And the other part is, of course, the cognitive dysfunction. And I like Dr. Jared Younger's term cognitive disruption much better, because it does. It disrupts everything that's going on in your brain.
That's spot on.
It's a beautiful term. And if you ask people are shy to tell you about this because it's embarrassing. It's humiliating that all at once you may not remember your children's name, your address, your phone number, when people usually thought of you as a very intelligent person, and all at once you have these horrible gaps every time you talk to someone. When I was sicker than I am now, my worst year was 1990. Before I would talk to anybody, I would write down my name, my husband's name, my children's name, my phone number, and my address in case it came up. Because if someone asked me something suddenly, I could forget it right on the spot. So I would have to write them down and remind myself. And that's a humiliating thing to do when you've been considered an intelligent person for your whole life and all at once, it's gone. But if you ask the question, if you say, what happens? Do you have trouble remembering things? People will usually laugh initially and say, oh, I seem a little absent-minded. But if you start there and dig a little bit, you start to find out the nature of that cognitive disruption. It's something that the doctors can diagnose. It's something that almost all of us with this illness can spot a mile away. They can do it if they're told that it's important. And the only people they're going to listen to telling them that it's important is the authority of the United States government.
I think you're spot on, exactly, and that is where this has to come from. I mean, I could speak to you for hours on this, because what you're saying about cognitive function or disruption, as is so well put, that was a brilliant description of it. I think, again, it's another area of this which is underreported, but that's going to have to be for another show. I mean, the thing that struck me, Wilhelmina, about you is it's been 36 years now that you have been living with ME, and yet, as I said in the introduction, you were out at your Millions Missing demo at Georgia. You're writing articles. There's a constant flurry of activity on your social media. I'm sure you're active in your community as well. It's such a long period of time. How do you keep going, and how do you maintain positivity and hope with the condition having been such a long-term one as it has been for you?
It's hard, but at heart, I believe in science. I believe if they do the science, we're going to have answers. The problem is that they have not done the science. They're just starting. They should have started 30 years ago. They didn't take this disease seriously. They spent a lot of time trying to prove it was some variety of depression or something else, but they never sat down and did the serious work required to figure out what this illness actually is, what's going on in our bodies and brains, and ultimately what they can do about it. This is starting to happen now. There are good researchers all over the place now, but not nearly enough. We need 10 more for every good person that's out there working hard on this. We don't know where our answers are going to come from. That's science in general. You never know where the answers are going to come from. And we need lots and lots of people working on this. And I believe that if enough people with good ideas and good intentions and the dedication to do the work right get out there and work on this illness, we'll be able to figure it out. So I'm going to keep pushing for that to happen as long as I'm here. I watched my daughter get sick from this illness. I have two wonderful, spectacular grandsons. I do not want to see a third generation of our family dealing with this illness. I don't want to see that. That's the thought that won't stop me in my tracks and send me out there to jump up and down and yell as long as I can. Pay attention. This is a serious illness. We're affected by it. African Americans are affected by it. I think of all the people who are undiagnosed out there. To me, living with this disease under the best of circumstances is a nightmare, but living without a diagnosis, that is a horror. That is a horror. When I did not know what I had, when I had no clue that anybody else had it. That was the worst time for me. And I don't want that to continue for other people. I live very close to to a system of historically black colleges here that includes Morehouse, Spelman, some of the premier historically African-American colleges in this country. And I think about the young people in those dormitories who have gone there with all the hope in the world, bright, bright young people, or they wouldn't be there, all the talent in the world, and how this disease can stop them in their tracks, and they will not know why if doctors do not tell them. Doctors can't tell them if the government doesn't make it clear that this is a serious illness.
No, absolutely. You're spot on, and it was a brilliant way to sum up the situation. I mean, I think so many people will probably relate to that. I know my partner will specifically relate to an awful lot of what you said with regards to the cognitive function, and also with sort of fears for your own children. But you're right. Do you know what we need? We need a lot more Stanfords, and we need a lot more David Tullers, and we need a lot more people who are making positive moves on this out there to really come together and fight this and get people living with ME some answers. Wilhelmina, it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. You had me enthralled listening to you. I could sit for hours, but unfortunately I have to put some sort of time limit on this podcast, which is sad to say, but it was a real pleasure to talk to you, and I really do appreciate your time coming on Topple Uncaged to speak to me. Wilhelmina Jenkins, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all that you're doing.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you. I would like to thank all my guests on this week's podcast. You can find more details about them in the individual show notes from each episode. I would also like to thank the ME Action Network. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at ME Act Net. And the UK group is ME Act Net UK. Of course, thank you to the ME Association as well. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at ME Association. And there are full details of all the activities these organisations are doing in the show notes. And last but not least, thank you to all the people living with ME, their families, friends, advocates and supporters out there. Society may have made you invisible, but trust me, you are not. You are very much visible. Keep fighting. Until next time, I will see you very soon.
The answer, my friend, is growing in me.